VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, Arsenal dropped two more points in their battle to lift the Premier League as Manchester City close in with another comfortable victory. We'll talk about Aston Villa's resurgence under Unai Emery. Could they make it into the top four? Brighton put in a stunning performance at Chelsea. Who, though, will their next manager be? We'll talk about Dean Smith's first game in charge of Leicester and all of the big stories at the bottom with huge wins for Bournemouth, Crystal Palace and Wolves. This is The Game. Hello again, welcome back to The Game Podcast. I'm Hugh Wisencroft, alongside Alison Rudd, Tom Roddy and Gregor Robertson, who are alongside me all together in a studio in London like magic to react to what was once again an eventful weekend of football with plenty of storylines. We're going to start throughout this podcast. I think I'm going to go from top of the table towards the bottom of the table, which means Chelsea fans, you'll have to wait. Bottom of the table, loads of stories there, but that will be towards the end of the podcast. And Man City, I've thrown you in with Leicester, so you'll have to wait as well. But we have to begin, I think, with events at the London Stadium. Arsenal missing a penalty through Bukayo Saka. They also threw away a two-goal lead, dropping points in the hunt for the Premier League title. It finished West Ham 2, Arsenal 2. Close-range finish from Gabriel Jesus. Martin Ødegaard volley had put Arsenal 2 up inside 10 minutes. They looked like they were cruising, but just like at Anfield last Sunday, they gave away the two-goal lead, and it means they dropped valuable points in the battle with Manchester City. So the question really when it comes to Arsenal is, are they cracking? Is this the moment? Is this it? Is this what everyone has been waiting for? Two games in a row, 4 points dropped, not what they wanted.
I love the headline of for the game because it was at West Ham. They went with, you know, forever losing 2-0 leads, not blowing bubbles. I think the problem with Arsenal is not that they're cracking, that they don't know quite what vibe to channel at this point in the season. So it wouldn't surprise me if for much of the season, Arteta has been reminding the team that they're ahead of schedule. No one's really expecting them to win the title. This is a good basis to grow from. If something wonderful happens, it happens. But now it's becoming a real thing. They're so almost overcompensating. They should be going into a real sort of hyper phase of giving it their all and trying really hard not to be overconfident. And I think they're scared that that is at odds with what they've been for the rest of the earlier part of the season. So they've overcompensated in that they're being a bit too relaxed. And I don't think that's arrogance or taking anything for granted. I just think it's navigating how to do it at this point. They're not used to it. Most of those players don't know what you're supposed to do in this situation. And I just think they've judged it incorrectly. So I don't think they're cracking, as in cracking implies the pressure's got to them and they can't play properly anymore. That clearly can't be true because they played so well for half an hour against West Ham and they played so well for half an hour against Liverpool. So they know how to play football still and impose themselves on a game really quickly, which is a talent in itself. One big reason why they're in this situation where they could win the title. But I think they're unable to, the way that City know how, proven you can switch off and still be effective. They don't know how to do that. So I don't think it's called cracking. I just think it's not knowing.
I just think they're not prepared to bore us, actually, Arsenal, because I think Arteta's made them such a process-driven football team. you know, it's all about style. And you see a couple of decisions made in that game where you're thinking, do you know what? Yeah, they're playing the game the way that the manager wants them to and the way that's brought them so much success this season. But they've got a two-goal lead. And suddenly they're not playing like a team who... It's just not in their mind. It's not in their DNA currently to make a game ugly, to make a game scrappy, to just kill it, make it dull. You've got the two-goal lead. Keep that secure. That's not yet...
I don't think he wants them to do that.
No, I know he doesn't want them to do that. That's my point. It's just not in their psyche at the moment to do that. And they haven't reverted. It's almost like they haven't realised that there is a different way. You know, it's all good. Play the beautiful thing. But once you've got the beautiful style of football, once you've got the two-goal lead, you can become a different football team. And you can see out a game in a different way. And they haven't yet developed that, I don't think.
I think he wants them not to take their foot off the gas. I think he alluded to as much in his comments as well, saying he started passing the ball for passing's sake rather than being direct, being attack-minded, still playing on the front foot, doing the thing that they do best. So you've got a perfectly valid argument. There's different ways to sort of see your games, but as Alisson's saying, they don't know how to do that. And as Arteta is saying, they're better doing the thing that they do so well and keep doing it. I think that's the problem. I think we're not seeing them cracking. I think we're seeing tension. And as Alisson is saying, they don't really know. Even, you know, they go two up early and they don't have the kind of, I don't know, there's not the same drive to continue to keep to get the third and a fourth.
There's a temptation to draw parallels between the two games because of the result, losing two goal leads for two games running. But and it was the, I think it was only the fifth time in Premier League history that's happened, which when you think it's a team fighting for the title would make you assume that they are cracking a little bit. But I think they're such different games, and the one at West Ham was so much more damaging because they're polar opposites, aren't they? Anfield and the London Stadium, absolute opposites. You expect that sort of thing to happen at Anfield. You never expect it to happen really at the London Stadium. And you could kind of see that in what Arteta said afterwards. It was too comfortable was one of the things he said. And it struck me that it was a really honest assessment, and that's what we want for us. But I didn't think he protected the players too much. I don't think you would see that from Guardiola at this point of the season. And, you know, there was that period where Guardiola was talking about wanting to see my team. I don't recognise my team. And all that mattered was how they looked, how they played. It was the process. And that was at a stage of the season where he was talking about the Premier League not really mattering too much. But they've now... This really is his team. And the big difference is kind of what you were talking about, Gregor, is that they tend to have these last-minute winners, Arsenal, quite often, whereas City have been... I think it's the... Paul Hurst wrote in his piece this morning that it was the first time in Guardiola's reign that they've scored three goals in six consecutive games. I mean, that shows what Arsenal are up against. It's...
And that's in the back of their mind too, surely.
Yeah.
It's got to be now. We've been talking about all season. Are they coming?
Yeah.
My God, are they coming?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's more important than ever to see
the main
games.
Thing is that they are coming rather than... There will be a temptation to say they're cracking and they're going to go into meltdown and draw parallels to last season. But in 21 of the... They're probably going to get 90 points, Arsenal, aren't they? Probably. And in 21 of the last 30 seasons, that would win you the title. So they're not... I don't think they are collapsing. I think they miss Saliba. I think they miss Zinchenko loads. And that squad doesn't have the depth that a lot of these teams at the top, especially Man City, have got.
So we're not going to use the phrase bottling at any point in time when it comes to Arsenal.
No. But if as Tom said, even if they get 90 plus points, we are in a different reality now. Like, it just hammers home how relentless City have become. And it's not by no means over. I just say it's tension. There's some tension. At this point in the season, that's what you're going to see. And part of that is because they know the City are coming. Part of it is about changing personnel. They've got, you know, defence doesn't look quite as strong. And even before then, Saliba and Gabriel were both starting to have a little kind of little wobbly period. So I think all those things combined, we're just going to see them. It's not cracking, but like the pressure is starting to tell a little bit.
Was there pressure in the penalty miss, do you think?
There's always pressure on penalties. They were 2-1 up.
I know it sounds weird because he scored a load of them, but I'm not a big fan of Saka on penalties.
He's too young still.
I just don't think he's a natural, actually. I think we're seeing more and more that even the penalty takers with, you know, the best technique, you know, some of the stuttering run-ups and deceiving the keeper and the players that even seem the most calm under that situation still aren't great penalty takers. I do think we were spoilt for a period of time where, you know, a player got the ball, you thought it was going in the back of the net. Even Haaland, you know, it went right in the corner at the weekend and I thought, was that a good penalty? Could have easily, the post could have easily gone wide. It looks like, in the end, a perfect penalty. You know, for me, he's just one of those kids that wants to score goals. So from the age of about 5, he was probably like, I'm on penalties. Doesn't matter if I'm good at them or not. I'm getting as many goals as I can. But I don't see Saka as a natural penalty taker. Good penalty taker, but not a natural. And I do think there's a difference in that situation.
I'd love to say it was a blunder that let West Ham back into the game from Partey. It was like,
yes and no. If you watch the situation, if the ball goes into Kieran Tierney, and I think all of his teammates point down the channel. This is what I mean about the difference in... It was one of the things that highlighted to me, okay, they clearly got, you know, process-driven patterns of play from Arteta, and Tierney stuck to it in a moment where most of the team were like, it's all right, just go along. Because it wasn't... Partey was under pressure, and obviously at 2-0, it's like, well, I don't need to give him the ball here. We don't need to really break through the press. We don't really need to keep possession. We can avoid any kind of danger by going long. And also, you know, look, we can talk about Thomas Partey. We can talk about a possible handball from Declan Rice in that moment. We can talk about whether Paqueta went down.
Yeah, Gabriel pulled out the challenge. Absolutely.
Before any contact. Because I think, you know, even though we're sitting here talking about, you know, our Arsenal cracking under pressure, you know, with the penalty miss, coupled with how West Ham scored their penalty, you kind of sit here and think, well, did Arsenal really deserve to win? You know, we're saying bottle, we're saying cracking, and actually we should be saying, you know, we're Arsenal robbed, but they easily could have won that game. They easily could have won that game. So might as well talk about those issues. What did we think? Rice handball, let's start there, Alison.
I couldn't see it. Saw a lot of angles, didn't see a handball.
Tom?
No, and also I actually, I know we're kind of getting into the whole laws of the game here, but I still think the Antonio one is harsh as well, because I just don't know what you do in that situation. It looks so odd, and it must be my playing career is long retired. When I was playing, I didn't have to even think about putting my hands down, but I can't imagine trying to defend and
run out of
accelerate
pace.
At pace at someone with your arms behind your back. I can't. So there is an issue there that's unresolved, but I think it's harsh for them to have conceded a penalty there.
You agree with that?
Yeah.
What did you make?
But as Tom's saying, like, still recognizing that there's a penalty in the VAR era.
Rice handball?
No.
No? Okay.
Are you? Sounds like it.
I tried to watch as many angles as I could today, and I got all my Arsenal mates saying it was definitely a handball. And there's a couple of angles where you think it must have hit his arm, but you can't see the ball actually hit the arm. And in my mind, it's like, we're all sitting there like, well, if we're computing it, saying there can't really be any distance between the ball and the arm. I can see that most of the arm. I can see most of the ball. There must have been a touch.
Well, maybe the future of VAR is artificial intelligence then, for that very reason, yeah. Hugh, that we can't see
it.
That
might be the future of football,
to
be honest.
But if the angles mean there was no possible way the ball went where it went unless it touched an arm, then AI would say that.
Or we could just say, so what?
But I think on top of it would have had to have been a deliberate handball, wouldn't it? Isn't there there's still a proximity factor when it comes to...
What did your West Ham mates say about the
Delighted with a point, to be perfectly honest. We'll take it all day.
But when they sit down, they're going to do this, aren't they? They're going to reconfigure the laws of handball and what it... One of them should be ricochets, because that's what happened with Antonio. It was a ricochet onto his arm. That is not... That shouldn't be a handball. They should change the rules for that.
Right, okay. What about Paqueta? I thought this was a clear dive, actually. And I know people are saying, well, Gabriel gave him the chance to do it by sliding in. I know he tried his absolute best to pull out of the challenge, but actually I thought this was an error from VAR, because before the contact, Paqueta is virtually horizontal. So for me, it's a dive. I know there's contact. I know Gabriel touches him. Funnily enough, he touches his right foot, which somehow he managed to put on that side of his body, even though he was running to the right-hand side. So he knew the contact. He knew a challenge was coming, clearly, Paqueta. But, we've had this debate time in the past of, well, look, it could still be a foul, even if he didn't mean to, because firstly, there's contact. The player knew the challenge was coming. He did what he could to get out of the way, and that's why he was going over, is trying to avoid injury and all of these things. But really, in my heart of hearts, the moment I watched it, I thought it was an outrageous dive.
No, I thought it was the cleverest dive I've ever seen, actually. Because I thought, first look, that's a penalty. Second look, it's a penalty. It took a few looks to realise what he'd done, and he did it beautifully.
Yeah. It's one of those where it is a dive. But it's also a foolish kind of engagement by the defender. He's like going to ground. Like I know it was, he could have shot first time probably too. So he kind of, I think that's why he was
not on his right. He's not going to do
probably
that,
not. But, but that's why he went to ground, and then you kind of, you sort of realise he brought his knees back, and it's one of those where from both sides, it was a foolish decision. But you have to give the penalty, I think, even if it is a dive.
Yeah. You can dive and
exactly, be
legitimately given a penalty at the same time.
Yeah.
It looked like Holding's about to clear the ball as well. I think he gets the ball first anyway.
It's a heavy, very heavy touch.
Yeah,
isn't it? Yeah.
But he knew he was dying.
I think the touch was, I'm going over here all day long. Yeah, anything, then shoot on my right foot. Just very quickly on West Ham, are they building the kind of form to pull themselves away from?
Well, no, I was in Ghent at the game on Thursday, and there were some really, really glum West Ham supporters on the Eurostar home the next day. Like, they knew, with the knowledge of Arsenal coming on Sunday, they were like, oh, this could be bad. And after the first half an hour or whatever, it could have been really bad. And as we've said, the atmosphere was ready to turn, if not already turning. So it was a really, really important and quite admirable turnaround for West Ham. They've created a little gap now, they're climbing, but I still wouldn't say that it's beyond them to get dragged back in, because they have performances like Thursday night's in the locker, which was horrendous.
Yeah. I'm going to the game on Thursday as well, I'm sure you are. I'm almost like, is it better for their season to get knocked out again?
No. They're too close now.
And they can.
They're favourites. It could be.
They have to win it, you're saying.
They don't have to win it, but if they win it, then the league, and they win it and they stay up and they finish, what is it, 17th or whatever, then
Europa League and...
It's forgotten. That side of it's forgotten, and something amazing's happened.
That's
so
true, yeah.
Like, Kufal was speaking to us before the game, and he was recognising that, saying, we finished 6th and 7th, and that's a great achievement for West Ham, but no one's really going to remember it that much. Like, if we win a trophy, a European trophy, and we just stay up by the skin of our teeth, this is a hell of
Who's
a season.
Who's left in it then? Who would they, if they
They would probably face
Anderlecht.
In the next, we'd have already faced in the group stage and beaten.
Well, there you go.
And hopefully that's over two legs again. And then I think Fiorentina are the only other kind of team that you would think that they're favourites. Absolutely possible that they win this trophy.
Ollie Watkins, let's talk about him. His great form continued. Two goals as Aston Villa boosted their European hopes. They beat Newcastle, who had a 5-match winning run coming into this game, by 3-0. Aston Villa made it 5 in a row themselves in the Premier League for the first time since 1998. John Gregory was the boss. It's now 14 goal involvements from Ollie Watkins since the World Cup, 11 goals and 3 assists. But they're improving. I'm still in I'm still in my mind wondering how good Aston Villa are, really. I think in this run, this was their best performance. This was definitely their best result. But, are they in a false position? They're up there in the Premier League, top 6 at the moment, but they played, I think, a couple of games more than Brighton, maybe one game more than Liverpool. I think top 6 would feel a little bit false for me.
That's really interesting. Are you saying that because you think, you look at the team sheet and think, there's no one there who excites me a lot? Are you remembering what they were like at the start of the season? Are you just not as thrilled by watching them as you are by a team like Brighton? Because I don't think they're terribly thrilling that often, Villa. Whereas they are one of the big stories.
Mm. Yeah.
Emery coming in, and we'll talk about Frank Lampard not having any bounce at all. Emery had it immediately. Mm. Within 10 seconds, they were playing better. I mean, it's astonishing what they were and what they are. I think it would be lovely if they were to make the Champions League.
Mm.
Absolutely amazing.
That is the conversation now. It seems
no, it's not.
It is the conversation.
They're not getting in the Champions League.
Well, no one's convincing above them.
They're
inconsistent above them.
I think it's been a nice run of fixtures. I don't mean to be harsh.
It only gets nicer. They've got Brentford, Fulham. They've got Wolves in the next seven games. There's strong potential.
Harsh with Brentford and Fulham, isn't
it? I've got some tricky games too. Like.
It's not. I'm not. I don't think there are any easy games towards the end of this season. But there's very, very winnable.
They play Spurs and they play Brighton too.
I watch it and I love. You all know that I really respect Unai Emery. I love Unai Emery. Love what he did. Always does with his teams. Tactically, it's great. It's very much like a proactive defensive system, you know, they're incredibly tough to beat. Lots of his teams have been incredibly hard to even score against, and clearly that is working at Aston Villa at the moment. But my point is really, when you look at the run, it's eight games unbeaten, but a victory over Everton, victory over Crystal Palace, who were playing really poorly, draw with West Ham, we know where they were when that, you know, they're in the relegation zone pretty much when that game happened, win over Bournemouth, win over Chelsea, who are pretty much the worst team in the league. Leicester, also down there. Nottingham Forest, also down there. And then, all right, like I said,
that's why we're seeing this.
Newcastle United, I get it. That's the best result in all of them. And that's why I ask, how good are they really? Because I feel like, as good as they've played, it's been a good run of fixtures.
I think when they haven't won, they've played well. And when they started, they were winning games people didn't. When Emery took over, he was winning games he wasn't expected to win. So I think they've had not just that run you've highlighted, but they've been performing well in all the games since he took over. They haven't played badly.
The system's pretty fascinating too. Like you mentioned how good they are without the ball, but like McGinn and Ramsey's roles are you know, they're kind of slightly, although they're right and left, they're slightly narrow. Rules, yeah. Also often when the ball goes into Buendia, they run from out to end, they don't hold wide to give the width to fullbacks often do that. They run across them. And that's so hard to mark. And then you've always got Watkins stretching the play as well. I mean, all we see of Watkins' best play is him running in behind.
Which he wasn't doing before Emery came in. He was trying to hold the ball up, which has never been his greatest strength. No. His greatest strength is playing off the shoulder of a defender and getting in behind. And they've got... It feels like Emery... It sounds quite simple, but he's using these players in the way they should be used. Buendia is being used in the right way. Watkins is being used in the right way. And then he's getting the best out of guys like McGinn. And Ashley Young, 38 years old, comes in and puts in an amazing performance at the weekend.
That is exactly the point, because under Dean Smith, Villa were a one-man team. It was Ollie Watkins. And every presser, Dean Smith would say, the work Watkins does for me, you know, it's not about his goal scoring, it's his movement, he gets stuck in on the wing, he helps me out defensively. I have never seen a player who works so hard and is so unselfish. And Emery's come in and said, no, you're a blooming centre forward. Don't do that. Don't do all that. Just do that. Mm-hmm. And Watkins is really enjoying it. He's got less responsibility. He doesn't feel the need to carry the team sometimes. And it's like watching someone grow up in front of your eyes. The interviews Watkins gave pre-Emery and he's given post-Emery, it sounds like a different person because he's been given advice and he likes the advice.
They absolutely blitzed Newcastle. How many teams have we seen do that to Newcastle this season? Like obviously Newcastle did a bit of an off day, but you know, I kind of agree with you. There's been that whole narrative in the background about how strong the teams are they've played in this run, and they've got some bigger tests to come as well. But this was one of them.
Yeah.
And they've passed it flying colours.
Yeah. The biggest compliment I give to the Aston Villa squad is I remember when Steven Gerrard was there and Unai Emery was appointed, and I basically said, I don't think this squad has the commitment to play the style of football that Unai Emery demands, because, you know, speaking about his other teams, the one hallmark of them is, I mean, it's out and out commitment to the cause, work rate, you know, it was incredibly high. And these were all of the things that were missing under Steven Gerrard. And I thought, well, it must be the players. I didn't think Joe wasn't a brilliant manager, but I thought the performances lacked all of the hallmarks of an Unai Emery team. And I thought he's going to need a couple of transfer windows to be able to work his magic, and he's just done it with the same group of players. Mm. I think credit to him, but also credit to the players, because their application's been miles better.
But also credit to Christian Perslow and the club for getting him in, because he is a very good manager and probably better than Villa, to be honest. So it was remarkable work to get him into the club. But also, it's quite inspired in terms of Villa are that club that are kind of middle of the table, and the kind of club that Emery has always overachieved with. I could easily see, I was saying that the conversation is Champions League football right now, and it remarkably actually is, because it's possible, and who knows how these final weeks of the season are going to go and the form Villa are in. It is possible, but I could see Villa going and winning the Europa League next year, because I know that's Emery's thing, but that just seems to be the trend they're on, and they're just brilliant to watch.
Why'd you say that he's better than Villa, Tom?
Sorry. you're looking for @TomRoddy Villa fans. Yeah.
Okay. We're Villa wearing the table, absolutely. But crikey, they weren't the most ambitious.
Them, weren't they?
I mean, obviously Newcastle, they were playing, are hugely ambitious, but so are they. Like, I think before the Saudi takeover, Newcastle, they had, like, I think they were the third wealthiest owners in the Premier League.
Yeah.
They want to be a in the conversation for the Champions League.
Villa have history. They are a big club. They have a huge fan base. They have a big stadium. They know what it's like to do well in Europe. Not recently, but they know what it's like. So why shouldn't Emery think, I can bring it back? That's what they've been after anyway for a long time, is someone who can bring it back.
And also he turned down Newcastle as well, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He did.
He's a man of honour.
It's crazy though, because every time I see Villa doing well, it's still the greatest sliding doors moment in Premier League history. The goal line technology and the goal that was never given against Sheffield United, that means basically Bournemouth were relegated instead of Villa.
And you're going to love this conversation today.
But it's just crazy to see, like I say, the soap opera football. I mean, it's brilliant. I mean, why would you watch anything else? Anyway. Okay, let's head to Stamford Bridge next. And teenager Julio Enciso, what a goal to win it at Stamford Bridge. Brighton coming from behind to beat Chelsea in the Premier League. First time they have ever won away at Chelsea in the league. It was Frank Lampard's first match at home since being reappointed as the Chelsea boss. Victory lifted Brighton to within a point of sixth place Villa, but they have played two games fewer. Firstly, just on this kid, Enciso, I think we have to reflect, kind of, Gregor, on the recruitment at Brighton here once again. £9.5 million from the Paraguayan side, Libertad Asuncion. But yeah, again, you know, 19 years old. I think that's the thing that struck. It wasn't even that they'd found a gem. It was that they'd signed a gem when he was 18, you know, from Paraguay. I don't even know how they're recruiting these players at Brighton.
It's incredible, yeah. I think I've referenced this, the cup game I went to see at Forest Green at the start of the season about 10 times now in this podcast, because the three players who I'd never seen before and watched play that night were Evan Ferguson, Mitoma, and Enciso. And like, look at the impact they've made a few, you know, several months on in the season. Yeah, Forest Green didn't know what hit them. And yeah, it's what a strike. Ridiculous. Absolutely beautiful strike. The recruitment is just incredible. I don't know what else to say about it. They find markets that other clubs don't know how to work as well, and exploit that advantage. And they've done it on a number of occasions now in South America. It's ridiculous.
There needs to be a documentary about Brighton, because we all know about the owner and the statistical approach to betting. And I'm kind of wondering if there's a bit of money ball going on at Brighton now, a statistical approach to recruitment. Might be. I'm just saying, I have absolutely no inside knowledge, but maybe they're looking at the underlying data and saying, we need a player that produces this. And they're looking at it across the world and seeing more players, obviously, their statistics mapped and GPSs and all of that stuff and stats being uploaded to the internet. And having a real global database of players is maybe helping Brighton. That is, of course, all speculation.
They do. They have. They do, yeah. I think they pay a fee to Bloom's company to you know, harvest that data.
Yeah.
But they also have created really strong relationships with scouts and clubs in South America. There was I know that Caicedo, when he came, there were just about every club in Europe were after him, but Brighton had signed a player before who's not made an impact, but they had a relationship with people in that region, and that counts for a lot, because normally the move for clubs for players in that area is to Brazil, sometimes Italy, sometimes often Belgium actually, and so a move directly to Premier League doesn't happen that often, and they formed the relationships that have made it easier.
And they always are a step ahead of the step aheaders, yeah. So they're always thinking not who's the player who's going to come in if we lose him. They're going, he's like playing chess. Well, you're thinking three or four moves ahead, and most clubs don't think that far ahead.
I also think it's just the stage and platform on which they play on, because you get a guy like Evan Ferguson, who at the beginning of the year, Oxford United were looking at taking him in the January transfer window. He plays a couple of games for Brighton and is absolutely brilliant, and there's no chance he's going anywhere near League One. Players come through like Mitoma straight into the team after Trossard, and I think Chelsea had played against Vinicius Junior a few days earlier, and it didn't get any easier with Mitoma there. I thought they were going to put in a bid for him by half time with the way things were going with Mitoma, but they are so impressive, and they looked like the team who should be playing Real Madrid this week, because fans who went to that game were being generous to Chelsea. They would say about the shuffling of the pack, the change, the tweaks to the team, and having an eye on Tuesday, because that is the big game for them this season. But it's not like Brighton haven't got FA Cup semi-final this weekend. They've got a game to look forward to, but you couldn't see it in that match at all. And also, they suffered setbacks. Ferguson came off really early with an ankle injury and will miss, or looks likely to miss, De Zerbi said on Sunday, looks likely to miss that game. And then Welbeck comes on and he's as excellent as he always is for Brighton, and Nciso scores the goal. There is always someone waiting behind to come in at Brighton.
I think they're the best team to watch in the league just now. Like, obviously that fluctuates, and City are looking ridiculous, and Arsenal have been brilliant all season. But they're fascinating to watch, like tactically, from a tactical point of view. Been a couple of the games recently, and the way that James Gearbrand wrote about it in his newsletter a couple of weeks back, the way they beat the press, they kind of stand on the ball. Or I was watching against Brentford, it was incredible. The Levi Colwill was kind of in the centre circle, taking little cushion touches forward, and Ivan Toney was like looking like he was on the starter blocks, ready to go for him, but not doing it. Like, what are you watching here? A centre half trying to say, come on. Yeah. And then
it's like Street Fighter before they start fighting. Two people are just bobbing up and down, waiting to approach one another.
Yeah, exactly. They're not unique in that, but they do it like really impressively, and also the way that they're wide play. Mitoma often hugs the touchline, but Solly March drives inside. He's always cutting and playing and crosses to the back post, and the way that they create overloads too. Caicedo is really the only one who sits, and McAllister and often Gross. Even when I watched him against Grimsby, he was playing at right back, Gross, but he went to play as an auxiliary number 10. So they always have an overload of the opposition's either back three or four. It's like they have these principles that they all know, and they've obviously been drilled so well in. And it's fascinating to watch.
Could be a very interesting Europa League for Premier League teams, depending on who gets there next year. Now, if Brighton could be in the Champions League, if they are, it might mean that Newcastle or Manchester United are in the Europa League. United again, but Newcastle will be interesting. A Spurs, a Villa, maybe a Brighton. Who knows what, the likes of Brentford could do. Even Liverpool, who knows? They might get into Europe this year. But exactly, yeah. Good news on this podcast, by the way. Liverpool aren't playing until tonight. So you didn't have to worry about that this week. But yeah, Tom, you were at the game. There are some big stories developing around Chelsea today. You have reported that Chelsea have held a meeting with Julian Nagelsmann as they aim to narrow down the shortlist of candidates to become their next permanent head coach. Paul Winstanley and Lauren Stewart, Chelsea's co-sporting directors, leading the process of recruiting Graham Potter's successor. They held the first in-person talks with Nagelsmann on Thursday. Is he the guy? Is he the favourite?
They insist not, that it's a wide-open race. You might ask why Nagelsmann would be attracted to
to Chelsea right now, if you look at the way they're kind of playing and performing. But yeah, they insist not, and it's a wide open race. They are looking to narrow down the short list. They're at about the middle stage of this process. And of course, whatever you think of them appointing Lampard as caretaker, it's just bought them a bit of time to complete this and make sure whoever it is the chosen one is right. They just don't want to make the same mistake they made before. And this is the crucial decision of their ownership. It feels like the biggest decision of their ownership, because they looked at hiring up-and-comers in the squad over the last two seasons, but also on the bench, because they saw that in Potter. And the acceptance with the squad is that some players might not make it. They might not fulfill their potential. And the problem was, the first one to show that in their eyes was Graham Potter. So now they've got to make sure that they don't make that same mistake again. And I think they will look for a bit more pedigree. And key thing with Nagelsmann is that you mentioned Lawrence Stewart, one of the co-sporting directors. He worked with Nagelsmann at RB Leipzig. Christopher Vivell, who is the technical director there, he worked with him at Leipzig and Hoffenheim as well, I believe. So naturally almost has a jump start on the other candidates. So I think he is the front runner at the moment, if he wants the job. You know, there's talk of the Real Madrid job is likely to become vacant this summer. PSG is probably going to become vacant too. Would they want him?
Isn't the key to all this, Tom, don't you think, whether the people they're interviewing are going to be honest when asked about what needs to be done? Will Chelsea want to hear someone say, well, the recruitment's been chronically bad and I think you need to get rid of 20, 30, 40% of people you've already just yourselves as new owners have spent money on? Do they want someone who's going to come in and say, oh, I think the recruitment's amazing, I can mould a fantastic team, I'm so glad you spent money on these players, which I think is the wrong approach? Or do they want someone to come in and say, well, you made mistakes, you've got it wrong, we need to, I know we're going to have problems with spending too much because of financial fair play, but we really don't want a squad this bloated. Who will they listen to?
I'm sure they want the former, because otherwise it's a bloody expensive
but that's not the
mistake.
Way
no, 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 of course not. And there's this idea of kind of yes men, isn't there? But I think the one thing that I personally think, it's a very good squad that desperately needs trimming, because it is bloated, as you say. But it's a very good squad with very good players in it. And I don't think they're, in terms of coaching, I don't think they're a million miles away. We saw that with Thomas Tuchel. He came in and transformed them overnight on the flight over from Paris to London, because he was a really elite coach with the right tools in front of him to just tweak a few things. But I think Potter struggled partially or largely because of that reason. Players will struggle to be motivated or feel any sense of certainty and confidence when they don't know if they're playing, when they're being chopped and changed each week. Because Graham Potter tried to keep them all happy, and it's hard to do with a squad that size, or maybe impossible. I'd be tempted. I don't think it'll be Pochettino. I don't think so, but I would be tempted for him, because I think he manages up extremely well, and I also think he has a reputation for developing players, getting the best out of teams, which is what they need and want to do. So I think he would be a smart way to go, but I don't think they will.
And to endear himself to the Spurs fans, of course.
Yeah, but I don't see Daniel Levy coming and banging on his door right now.
That's true.
So go and sit unemployed just so you don't ruin your legacy with us.
See if he gets Harry Kane in the summer. in that case. Sure, you won't mind either. Anyway, Chelsea facing Real Madrid at Stamford Bridge on Tuesday in the Champions League quarterfinal second leg. Remember, they lost 2-0 at the Bernabeu last week. Dean Smith, who was also another interim boss, this time his first game in charge of Leicester, and he was 3-0 down at Manchester City after 25 minutes. There was a bit of a resurgence. It only finished 3-1 in the end. The Foxes deep in trouble, 19th, 2 points off safety at the moment. Interestingly, Dean Smith said, "We came into the match with a plan to stay in the game." So that worried me quite a lot, obviously going 3-0 down so early, but they did have a number of chances later on. Could have made it a very different story. So they just have to build on that second half moving forward, I think. I'd still be very concerned if I was a Leicester supporter.
But you can't, he can't, because it was his first game, he can do that. He can say, let's forget the first 45 minutes and let's focus on how you took on board some of what I was trying to talk about. In the second 45, they were different in the second half. They had a bit of buoyancy, energy. They stopped looking scared of Man City. And Dean Smith, unlike Brendan Rodgers, knows how to get out of a relegation tussle. He can be as pragmatic as is necessary. So it looks they're in a tricky situation, but at this point, if I was a Leicester fan, I'd be thinking, I'm going to go with it. I think Dean Smith could just make it happen.
Agree?
Yeah, look, we said last time, it was basically about a change of atmosphere, and this game was a bit of a kind of, not a free hit, but it was like, they knew what they were, you could see from kickoff, in fact, that how they were coming to play. Just so defence, you know, so sitting behind the ball, two blocks, and hardly any attempt to kind of spring forward. And in the second half, when they had kind of nothing to lose as well, they did show some real life and had a few chances that could have made the game like a little bit touchy for City. Madison springs to mind when he went through on goal and tried to pick out the near post. But the games, you know, the next few weeks, they've got Wolves next. They're
on Saturday.
That's a huge game for them, obviously. And we know Wolves are kind of pulling away now, but that's a game that you look at in the running and think it's got to be one they get points from.
Next so three games are massive for them: Wolves, Leeds and Everton. And we've seen from Roy Hodgson at Palace what a few points can do. Suddenly you look at Palace and just think, oh, they're fine now because they've just pulled away with a couple of wins. And that's...
Three
wins. And that's how tight it is at the bottom right now. You pick up a few wins and you get away from it all, but you can be dragged straight back in. But this is the period right now for Leicester. It's a huge, huge period, and the form is just horrendous. 9 defeats in 10 games, 1 point in that period. That is relegation form. They deserve to go down for that right now, and it's kind of unthinkable.
But maybe all they needed was to accept properly that they are in a relegation battle, and appointing Dean Smith makes that what it is. Whereas under Rodgers, it was almost, well, we're far too good to be in this mess. You know, it'll be fine.
Too good to go down.
See the goals as well that City scored, that sliced, well, Stones' strike, wow.
Yeah.
And then De Bruyne's little pass for the run that was perfectly timed and cushioned in the outside of his left foot to Haaland to bring it through and lift over the keeper. There's not a lot you can do about that, and it could have been, you know, it could have been a humbling afternoon after that opening half an hour. So I think they'll take some encouragement from the second half display.
I'm still doubtful that they'll stay up. I know you can't take a lot from this match. Obviously, Man City away. Mm-hmm. What did they have? 71% possession or something ridiculous. It was obviously two sides who were on different levels. But the only thing I'd say is the forward players for those next three matches have to click. Like, there has to be something going forward. If I'm Leicester, I'm almost like, I don't care. If all those games are 4-3, perfect. You know, it's honestly, you just have to win them. But the players in front of goal, I think, is where you've probably got more difference makers in your team. Yes, obviously, they haven't delivered throughout the season. Seen a bit of life from Iheanacho of late.
So hot and cold, though.
Yeah. This is what I'm saying. All you need to do, hot for those three games. That's all I care about if I'm a Leicester fan. And we'll see if Dean Smith can turn it around. it has to be, I think you're right, Tom, about the change of environment. I don't think we're going to see anything tactical to astound us to see Leicester get out of this. So hopefully that environment does change. Just very quickly on Manchester City, because we were talking about the title race a little bit earlier on, and they just look relentless now. It's sad for us all to see, because it looks like they're going to reel in Arsenal, and no one wants that to happen, do they?
Yeah, but when they crash out of the Champions League, it will affect them. Their psyche, won't it? So there's hope.
But they won't, will they?
Crash out of the Champions League. It's what they usually do.
Not in this round, though. You think semi-finals. I wouldn't call getting to the semi crashing out, though. You made the semis.
Yeah, but from their point of view, that is crashing out. Given how much money their squad is worth and the manager they have, the fact that they haven't won it is getting deeply embarrassing. And to not make the final is acutely embarrassing.
I've started to think about the treble when it comes to Manchester City.
Although
it sounds mad because they're only in the semi-final of the FA Cup. They haven't yet reached the semi-final of the Champions League. They're not even top of the Premier League.
Although there's a reason, like we always get sucked in from like recency bias. It's like we're having this conversation about Liverpool winning quadruple. Yeah. There's always something that can be like a bit of bad luck. Could be an injury. It could be just one off day.
Well,
stops it. But they look relentless, as you say. And this is what they do every year at this time of year. And they're always in the conversation. And there've been reasons why they've slipped up. Obviously, Haaland's a big addition this year. It's possible, but it's going to be no mean feat if they did so. One little nugget from Bill's column, which I thought was astounding today, is that in the past year, City have scored 101 more goals than Chelsea in all competitions. 155 to 54. I mean, I don't know what to take from that, but it's amazing.
Chelsea have scored 54 goals in a year.
Is that the way you're looking at it?
That's the takeaway. I thought it'd be like 250 to 150. Okay, all right. Bloody hell. Yeah.
But they are. They're what is it, 10 wins in a row, unbeaten at 14 in all competitions. As Tom said before, 3 goals, 6 games in a row, 3 goals or more. They're purring. And even though they took, he was taking people at half time, taking people off in 60 minutes, he had that luxury. And that's the other thing. If they're kind of steamroller in teams and they can manage their resources because they have more games than everyone else, that'll be important.
They've got a lot more games than everyone else. It will obviously come down to the game that the Etihad between Manchester City and Arsenal. I think in terms of this title, I still think Arsenal have a lot to give the league this year, and obviously they're going to play a lot fewer matches than Manchester City if City do get through to the two finals they've got in cup competitions. So
Sad, man.
It kind of makes me sad, but I'll leave the conversation for if it happens, if City win the Premier League title again. Not because I don't want Man City to win the title, but because of the wider context of what would that be, 5 out of 6? And what that means for English football, really. So I'm kind of trying to put that to the back of my mind at this point in time and hope that Arsenal do something that we can turn around and say, wow, a team with less money.
The only thing is, though, they're not steamrolling every single year. It's not quite that league where they're winning by the margins that they were a few years ago.
But they're forcing other teams to hit heights that are like unprecedented.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the thing is, you don't want it to be you don't want it to get silly where teams are getting over 90 points, but Man City still win it. So, I mean, it's like if you were another club and you think, we get 90 points this year, we can win the Premier League. It's only City that can beat you if you get 90 points, but they can, and they have done. And that's the thing, it's if they have an off year, 95 points. If they have an on year, 101, 102. It's like, that's the thing. It's such a high bar and it's only when it comes to Manchester City. So a little nugget here as well, statistically, Kevin De Bruyne, 15 or more assists in a single Premier League season for the fourth time in his career. How many other players have done it more than once?
Well, I don't know, but I guess you're saying because none.
No.
Ozil.
No.
He's not done it more than once?
He's done it once.
Okay.
13 players have done it once. One other player has done it more than once. That player is Cesc Fabregas. And Kevin De Bruyne has done it 4 times. It's incredible. Anyway, love him. We all love him. Let's move on.
Haaland loves him.
He's the only player at Manchester City that when he makes the run that stretches the defence goes, all right then, I'll just turn it around the corner, I'll play the through ball, and it's inch perfect.
But he was complaining to him after the game on Saturday about not having enough space. Haaland went up to De Bruyne and was complaining that he didn't have enough space to play. And of course, the difficulty that he has in English football is playing against De Bruyne, playing against Haaland. You're going to get five at the back, four in midfield, and just pack it. So
he's managing all right, though.
He's doing okay.
He's doing okay. 47th goal of the season. Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous. I think in Europe's big leagues, it's only Kylian Mbappe who's got over 30 at this point, 31.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Best result of the weekend, as far as I'm concerned, because Bournemouth kept it going, okay? You got to ride the wave if you're going to stay in the Premier League, if you're Bournemouth. Dango Muachra, a stoppage time winner, stunning finish at Tottenham. You thought it was going to be a Bournemouth win, Spurs equalise, then Bournemouth go down the other end and snatch the winner. Dramatic finish. It was 3-2 in the end, and Bournemouth make it four wins out of the last six Premier League games. After winning at Leicester last week to move out of the bottom three, the Cherries are now 6 points clear of the drop zone and in 14th. And you want to say it's going to be tight. In my mind, I'm like, are they already safe?
I think they may be.
And it's tough. It's tough to call right now, but they might be. They might be kind of 3 points away from definitely being safe, because you can't see two of the teams in the bottom three, two of the three that could go down with Southampton, it seems, at this point in time, getting that many points. So it's very, very close for Bournemouth, if not done already. But yeah, you might as well give me your view on that, Gregor.
I did a little sort of analysis of about a month back, maybe, of the kind of relegation battle. And I think I look back over the last 10 seasons and Everton were on course at that point as the team who were in 18th to get 32 points. And the average is, I think, 33. So over that period of time, so I think another point would almost make it pretty certain for them. If you look at the teams down there, look at Leicester, Southampton, Forest and Everton. Can you see two or three of them getting two or three wins out of seven games, I think it is?
No.
I honestly think it could be quite a low threshold this year. And anyway, Bournemouth, I think they've been in magnificent form. Even before their results turned, there were some really narrow kind of like defeats or draws where they kind of conceded late. And although their immediate form after the World Cup was shocking, their performances after that weren't quite getting the results they deserved, and now they are. I thought they were brilliant.
They were just so underestimated, weren't they? I mean, I for one, I'm sure there were loads of people assumed they were gone. It was over, probably as early as autumn, because of the form they were in, and you know, holding my hands up, they put Gary O'Neill in charge, and it feels slightly uninspired and unambitious, really. And the truth is that he's shown himself to be a really smart manager, and the job he's done isn't too far. His name should be mentioned in the Manager of the Year nominees because of what he's done there. Even the Alisson will be able to talk about this more than I can, but even the game on Saturday at Spurs, because he matched them up, didn't he? He went three at the back, and they were so much more effective. And the one thing he has done, we started this podcast talking about Arsenal and tension. This is a team at the bottom of the table who have been facing relegation all season. And they seem to play without any tension, especially that last minute winner. There was a freedom, and there he has managed to ingrain a siege mentality into that team that has driven them to seemingly to safety. Because I think, looking at the table, looking at the fixtures, I think they probably are safe now, which is remarkable from a few months ago.
The best thing that happened to Bournemouth was losing 9-0 at Anfield. When they got rid of Scott Parker, who didn't believe they had the resources to get out of trouble and stay in the division, and they brought in Gary O'Neill. And I went to Bournemouth on Wednesday last week to interview Philip Billing, and I said, you know, we don't know much about Gary O'Neill. What's he like as a manager? And he said, oh, he just, you know, he does all the tactical work, but he tells us to enjoy ourselves. Let's just play with freedom. And that has been the key. You know, it doesn't matter the circumstances. On Saturday, they left their hotel and then got stuck behind a van that caught fire on the North Circular. They were sat still for 55 minutes. And the amount of emotional energy that went into trying to get the kickoff delayed, because you can't warm up when you get to the ground if you're 55 minutes late. Mm. And 15 minutes wasn't enough. So they had that underlying concern about, gosh, you know, this could have a knock-on effect on our season if players start pulling up with hamstrings and whatever, because we haven't had time to warm up. They got the 15 minutes. I mean, really, that should have meant they were wobbling a bit. They weren't able to do what they wanted to do. And maybe you could say, well, they probably did wobble initially because Spurs took the lead. But they didn't at any point play like they were scared or inhibited by the build-up to the game, or inhibited by the fact they'd gone behind against Spurs. It's the opposite, actually, of what the situation that Leicester are in. Leicester now have to embrace the fact they're in a relegation battle and play pragmatically, you know, nastily or boringly or whatever it takes to stay up. Whereas Bournemouth are in this situation where they're in a reasonably good position, certainly better than most of us thought they'd be, by playing with... They're attractive to watch. As you say, they're tactically fluid. You know, everyone predicted they'd play four at the back and they didn't, because they decided, no, against Spurs, that's not what we're going to do. Not a problem. Eased into it perfectly well. And then play with freedom and enjoyment. And, you know, you just think, well, I that 9-0, would anyone have said, oh, they're going to stay? No. So they almost needed that real horrible embarrassment and shock to rethink everything. And instead of worrying about the lack of money in investment, they bought a bit, didn't they, with the new owners? But they've done just enough, I think.
They also stuck with Gary O'Neill. You know, often when a new ownership group comes in, you know, Americans, ambitious, certainly want to keep Premier League status, and they've been on some bad runs.
Yeah.
And they stuck with him. I think that might owe quite a lot to Simon Francis and Richard Hughes, the co-technical directors who kind of were part of the discussions in terms of the takeover and what needed to happen. And I think, you know, wouldn't it have been surprising if they were going to get some edgy feet. But I think they saw, because Gary O'Neill was not in the running whatsoever for that job. Like, you know, we saw Bielsa being thrown into the mix, we saw lots of names, and he kind of forced his way, you know, with performances and results into getting the job, and he's done a remarkable job. Just looking the over the last 10 seasons, the team finishing 18th and relegated have finished with an average of 33.9 points. The lowest was Fulham with 28 in 2000, 20-21 and the highest Newcastle of 37 and 15-16. That's a relegated team. So I think, and on this current trajectory, it's looking like a lower points tally than normal. So they could be safe. They might need another point or two, but they're just about there.
There's going to be some brilliant... The final day of the season is going to be incredible. So
that's the only thing, yeah. The team's playing each against each other. If it's tennis concertina, then it's kind of...
Everton, Bournemouth, is Leicester, West Ham play each other as well. That is going to be some end to the season.
Alison, you were at the game, of course, and there have been Spurs headlines. Hugo Lloris coming out to say he's kind of unhappy with his own fans for booing Davinson Sanchez. Said he'd never witnessed anything like it in his career. Sanchez, I think, was brought on at 35 minutes, two goals conceded by Spurs before he went off on 59. And you could see he cut a very lonely figure on the bench as well. What did you make of that inside the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium?
Yeah, well, he came on because Longley was injured and so he had about 25 minutes in total on the pitch. The thing that Lloris couldn't get his head round was it wasn't, well, you have a player booed when he comes on. That's not great, is it? You have a player cheered when he's taken off. That's not great. But what really got to Lloris was he was also booed every time he touched the ball in between, which is phenomenal. And Lloris does, he says he doesn't know. He suggests that might have been one of the reasons why Spurs lost the game, because the atmosphere wasn't great. And you, if you're going to win games, you need a good atmosphere. And he's bang on. I'm not 100% sure, but I think this is the first, certainly it would only be the second, and it's been a while since I've been to the Tottenham Stadium this season. And so had I forgotten? I don't know. I was surprised by the atmosphere. I remember when it was built, they thought about building, you know, a wall, like a wall of noise, they called it. And they had Dortmund in mind and that sense that it would be the place that no one wanted to go. And it was just rubbish. The atmosphere was absolutely rubbish. Like, the cheer for taking the lead was a sort of ho-hum cheer, like, oh, well, might be a quite nice afternoon. Not sure, probably be all right. It wasn't, they roared their team on for about 5 minutes in total. And you just think, and then there's the booing of an individual. And I bet a large proportion of the Spurs fans were embarrassed about that, the booing of one of their own players. It wasn't that all of them felt that way. The minute that Bournemouth fans sing "We're staying up," the Spurs fans counter with "We won't leave you out." It's like they're not watching the game. They've got an agenda. They want things to be different to what they are. And as Lloris pointed out, yes, everyone would like things to be better and for us to know the direction we're going in and who the manager's going to be and so on, and that we're assured of Champions League football. But you're not going to get any of those things if the plushest, glitziest stadium in the land is also one of the easiest to go to. I was astonished, really, by the behaviour of quite a lot of the fans in different ways.
I do find the kind of psychology around Spurs really interesting, because as soon as Conte was sacked, and then, I guess, Christian Stellini put in charge, which I think was a big thing alongside Ryan Mason, it's just felt like everyone's gone, oh, that's it, the season's over, despite the fact that they were still in the top four at the time. And they could easily finish in the top four still if they have a decent run of form. But
very easily.
Like you point out, everything is about the bigger points around the club and the issues. And it feels like no one is even really that interested in the football, despite the big target that's left for the rest of the season. I find it really weird, including the Davinson Sanchez thing, which I felt was one of those moments where the fans are really trying to say, why is this player still at the club? Why haven't you invested more? Why don't we have a better squad? Rather than having a massive dig at Sanchez, I think they're just using everything they can to, like you say, let Daniel Levy know, like, you need to sort this out. But I do think, well, look, you've got a match in front of you that you need to, your players kind of need you to beat Bournemouth. They need your support and you're just distracted by other stuff.
Also, Pedro Porro's getting off lightly then. Yeah. Thank goodness. Like, they've got a £39 million obligation to buy him in the summer. I don't know, as reports say.
They did boo him once.
He's been, like, not good. I don't know, I'll be polite about it. I watched him against Scotland for Spain as well, and he was, like, really hot-headed, and he just doesn't look like...
I knew Gregor would find a way to get Scotland, Spain.
But he's made several errors for goals, and he... doesn't like he can defend.
And,
like,
and he had a good chance, actually, which sailed miles in the air. And that was one of the points at which the mood went sour again after it had been buoyant for a few minutes.
He's coming in a difficult situation. There's no way, you know, you don't want to write him off or anything, but just another example of the recruitment which hasn't been a success.
I think you're right, Hugh, that it is. Sanchez was almost a symbol of something far, far wider. He was the scapegoat and a bit of a punch bag, really, to the Spurs fans during this game. And I just think it's frustrations and a disconnect between a fan base and a club and a squad that's been going on for 5 years. Four years now. And I know this is a different situation, but it wasn't so long ago that you had Eric Dier storming up the stands, into the stands. And you just think of these incidents and what happened with Sanchez. It doesn't happen at clubs that often. So it's quite strange. And I just think it's there. What's weird about Spurs is that their season feels like it's really petering out. And yet,
it feels like it never a lift off. No. And yet, as we've said this whole season, but they're still like...
That's what I mean. They can still qualify for the Champions
League. It's really, really weird, yeah.
Which is a par, hitting par for the season, isn't it, really?
They're desperate for a sense of identity as a football club. All of these issues, all of these things that you mentioned, Tom, it just come from the group, the fans, the hierarchy of the club, coaching staff, and the group of players just not being on the same page. I just think it's going to be hard for some people to take the reality of what that page should look like, which for me is we haven't got as much money as a number of clubs above us in the Premier League. We've invested a huge amount into the stadium, into the training ground. We've got huge debt, so we're not going to be able to spend. So we either sit down and say, what's our strategy within this budget? But also, I think on top of that, you kind of have to say, you know, are Spurs going to be a really Europa League team for the next few seasons? And do we kind of go all out to win that competition and see that as our way, maybe our best way of getting into the Champions League? Because I think we're about to see them take a bit of a step back, particularly if they lose Harry Kane.
Yeah. Stop hiring women arsonists as manager.
Yeah, for me, I'd love to see Luis Enrique at Spurs, to be perfectly honest. Again, in terms of that identity, Tottenham have always wanted to play football, whether they're a mid-table side or a side that's pushing for Europe or even got close to a title. And I think the move away from that has led to, I think, so many people, fans being a little bit disenfranchised, because obviously they're like, well, look, it's all good to play bad football. If we win stuff, we're not winning stuff. So take us back to why we love Spurs, which is nice football and some creative players and something that we can applaud on a Saturday. So we'll see. Do you just very quickly on that final point, Alison, think that going forward, Spurs will have to kind of change their... not targets is probably the wrong thing. They should still aim as high as any other club, if you like. Like Ivan Toney said, Brentford go out to win the league. Why not? But in terms of what is realistic for Tottenham, what the expectation should be, I think that's going to have to change a little bit, isn't it? Or am I wrong?
No, because they're doing so much that's wrong and yet could quite very easily secure Champions League football this season, which gives you a fantastic base financially and attention globally and allows you to attract good players. I mean, Stellini went right down in my estimation because he's essentially the caretaker and he didn't shake O'Neill's hand. He disappeared down the tunnel and left Ryan Mason to do it. I can't prove this, can I? But I'm sure before he got tainted by the Spurs bug, he wouldn't have dreamt of behaving like that. It's just mildly toxic at the best of times there. I don't think it would help them in any way to lower their expectations. I think they need to, the opposite in a sense, they need to recognise the opportunities they have, but just invest in better football brains behind the scenes and maybe get the balance slightly better. There's a lot of effort and energy goes into making money from the stadium and making it an event destination. They want it used all the time.
And effort,
It's an NFL. It's, you know, those things should be seen as boosting the football, not detracting from it. And if you can crack that, you can think big.
Okay, very finally, before we go, a couple of clubs in the relegation battle that I wanted to mention. Diego Costa scoring a first Premier League goal in nearly 6 years at Wolves, beating Brentford and now 7 points above the drop zone. Again, you'd have to feel that they are safe. And Crystal Palace, a third straight win under Roy Hodgson, 9 points clear of the drop zone, and I'd say they're definitely safe now. But that did leave Southampton rooted to the bottom of the table and looking likely to go down. On Palace, Eberechi Eze, beautiful second goal in particular, but looking far more confident. He can be key to them having a good end to the season. And who knows, if Diego Costa can score a few for Wolves, they can have an even better end to the season. What do you think of these two sides?
Eze was sublime, wasn't he? The little kind of shuffle of the hips to turn the defender, and then a strike. Yeah, he looks just like he's brimming with confidence. Yeah, the opposite of what... I mean, to be fair, he'd been left out a lot towards the end of Vieira's tenure. So, but you see, this is what's always been the case with Palace. You think they've got so many players who, like, when they've got kind of their eyes are twinkling and they look like they're confident, they want to be on the pitch and they're enjoying themselves. That forward line alone is like enough to bring you joy when you watch them. But it hasn't been like that for so long. And again, we're talking about the change of environment and atmosphere, possibly the fact that Hodgson is someone they knew before. It's been a remarkable impact.
And let's not forget, they're doing this without Zaha. And there was that long, long spell. If Zaha wasn't playing, they could not win.
Yeah.
And they've won three on the trot without him.
Yeah. But Elise and Eze are just two players that they fit brilliantly with Palace. You think that they could possibly go on to bigger and better things, but they need to do it on a consistent enough basis. But they're safe. And Wolves, I think, pretty much are safe as well. Built on the back of, like, really well-organised defence. And, you know, they're starting to find the odd goal here and there, but they still need to invest, I think, in forward areas of the pitch. And,
yeah,
and some...
I'm not quite convinced Diego Costa's going to be doing it too much towards the end of the season.
He scored with a block.
He was amazing in his last spell in English football. He looks a little bit like a competition winner back at Wolves this season.
I didn't really plan to discuss Everton, but I guess I might as well mention them after their defeat at home to Fulham 3-1. Looking so devoid of confidence and energy at home, you kind of thought, oh, they can't muster something more than this at Goodison Park against a Fulham side that hasn't been in great form over the last few games. Then what hope have they got? It was a dejecting performance, really.
It was bad. And in fact, in the past, no matter what's gone on the pitch, you could sort of, Sean Dyche will do something that, as a manager, give you hope. If it's just the way he talks about the game, well, he's a very good manager at just writing a game off. He's the one that makes you believe it. It's all right, we're here, we're gonna sort it next time. It was the first time I've seen Sean Dyche post-match look slightly concerned. And like, oh my goodness, I don't know what's going on. Yeah, and that's what, if I was an Everton fan, that would really worry me, because as if I was an Everton fan, I would have been really happy at his appointment. You know, no nonsense, get stuck in, know what you have to do, add a bit of edge to the team. And there have been elements of that. But this performance was, because yes, Fulham were there for the taking, because they've got nothing to play for, really. They're safe, they're happy. They're doing a lot better than anyone thought. They had the manager in the stands looking moody. I mean, it was... I thought he looked worried. Dyche.
He said... I suppose it's what happens now, how he reacts. And he said that. He said, it's what... You know, how do the players... They don't say, woe me or something, I think he said. Paul Joyce referenced Frank Lampard's kind of reaction when the same thing happened. Because it's what Everton players have done to several managers now. They have an uplift. They show that they are decent players, good players. But then they've got this in their locker, they can go under. And as Dyche said, it was worrying to see them go under. But Frank Lampard said, you know, there was talk about, I think it was the players' lone confidence. And he said, well, there comes a point where it's not about, have they got the confidence to say, have they got the bollocks to play? Like, and I don't think that went down very well. So Dyche, you know, I think he's treading that line, and it's how he gets the most from these players until between now and the end of the season, if he can. Because
yes,
others have failed.
Right. Yeah, if he can now put something together that means they escape relegation, that will be one of the stories and one of the great managerial tricks of the season, because I think it's looking like the tide's against him now.
Yeah,
huge game at Crystal Palace next up for Everton. It's going to be very tough for them between the end of the season. We didn't really talk about Southampton, but was that the fixture that you kind of, you know, felt that was it?
Bring back Hasenhüttl. Who? I mean, don't most people think if he was still there, they might be in with a chance? Yeah. I'm not saying they'd be mid-table, but I think they wouldn't be quite so cut adrift.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Because he was one of those managers who would get it wrong by getting it right, and they'd get trounced. But, you know, the players seemed to like him a lot, and most of the players seemed to like him a lot, and he'd get a reaction. So I think if he was still there, you'd be getting a win, draw, loss, loss, win, draw. That's what you'd be getting.
Two wins and a draw and three defeats every six matches, basically.
Yeah.
Not in that order, just, you know, yeah. roughly getting
yeah.
enough.
Yeah. And certainly his stats are better than the current
yeah.
stats. So
they play Forest, they play Bournemouth after Arsenal. They're obviously must wins, basically. And they've got some tough games. They've got Liverpool, Brighton, Newcastle, and Arsenal, as I said. So, yeah, it's looking tough for them. But if they don't win those two games against the teams of them, then they're doomed.
Yeah. Leeds were spared the relegation chat. They take on Liverpool a little bit later, who were also spared the relegation chat. But of course, we're going to react. All right, okay, I was only trying to wind you up. We'll react to the Champions League football, big games for Manchester City and, of course, Chelsea. We'll see what Frank Lampard can muster in the second leg against Real Madrid. We'll react to all of that on Thursday. So thank you for being with me, Tom Roddy, Gregor Robertson and Alison Rudd. Thank you all for listening. Make sure you check out the game today. It's Monday, of course. Pick up a paper. You can also go online, thetimes.co.uk/the game, or make sure you download the Times app. We'll see you soon.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.